Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You may be seated. And I see that we're all ready to begin. I understand that the respondents and appellants aren't splitting time either way. Is that right?
That's correct.
And who's arguing on behalf of the appellant?
I am. David
Thank
Olson.
You. Good morning. Then let's proceed. Would you please call the case? And when you begin, you'll each have 15 minutes, 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please state your name for the record. And you can, as you see, use either individual podiums or the one in the middle that goes up and down. And are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
You may.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm David Bradley Olson, Henson Ephron, Minneapolis, on behalf of the appellant, Douglas Mellark. This is a dispute between shareholders of a $50 million family-owned corporation. Douglas Mellark, a shareholder, director, officer, and employee of the Mellark Companies, brought this action under Minnesota Statutes 302A.751, asking for a temporary injunction to restore the parties to the position they were in prior to May 13, 2022, when his co-shareholder and ex-wife, Cheryl Mellark, unilaterally and without any semblance of process, suspended his employment, locked him out of his office, locked him out of the company information systems, hired security guards to keep him off the company property, and took custody of all of his files and records, including his personal files and records and other personal property. The primary issues before the district court on the motion for temporary injunction were whether Cheryl Mellark had the legal authority to unilaterally seize control of the family-owned corporation, and if not, whether Douglas Mellark is likely to succeed on his claims that she violated his rights and reasonable expectations as a shareholder, director, and officer of the company.
What I would like you to address is what the irreparable harm is and why money damages wouldn't make him whole if he were to succeed.
Yes, Your Honor. The ongoing harm to Mr. Mellark is irreparable because, number one, he's been deprived of his rights and benefits incident to the ownership of the company. We have to remember here that
I thought he had tendered, they call it a Texas shootout, but I thought that he wanted to sell his shares.
There was a time limit on that, Your Honor, and it was a 60-day expiration period. No money for the purchase price was tendered within the 60 days, and as we stand here today,
but we don't know that because that's not in the record, right?
As of the time of the hearing, there was a Texas shootout provision, but at the time of the hearing, no money had been tendered, and the sale had not gone through. It was
I thought 10% earnest money had been put down.
10% had been put down, but the remainder of the money had not been due, and it was undisputed at the time of the hearing before the district court that whether Cheryl Mellark can come up with the rest of the money to finance her purchase was in grave dispute. In fact, she submitted a declaration that said because of this lawsuit, she would be unable to finance her purchase. So when we were before the district court, it was absolutely clear and there was no dispute that this sale had not gone through and it was likely to not go through. So at the time of the hearing, Mr. Mellark was a shareholder. He was an officer, he was a director, and that's what the district court should have considered.
And he was being paid his full salary.
He was being paid a salary, Your Honor. But you've got to remember, as a shareholder of the corporation, his wealth is tied up in the corporation. Dividends are paid by the corporation. He has no ability to control those dividends. He has no ability to control corporate expenditures.
Where is that in the record about the dividends? It's a very sparse record. We have what I would term dueling declarations in this case.
It's a family-owned corporation, Your Honor, and in the record, there's no dispute that 75 cents of every dollar is a dollar that goes to or should go to Douglas Mellark and the trust that he is the trustee of by virtue of his ownership of the shares. The trust and he together have beneficial interest of 75% of this corporation, yet he's been denied any semblance of control. He's been denied access to any corporation. He doesn't know how the money is being spent. He doesn't know if the money is being wasted. And that constitutes irreparable harm if we look at Haley versus Vorsell, which we've cited. And there's another case that cited Haley versus Vorsell, which is Bolt versus Burns. It's a 2008 Westlaw, 521-5721. And in that case, the same question was present. This court said, respondent lost the ability to manage and watch over the corporation that she helped found and control. We conclude that it will be virtually impossible to account for the damages, and they would defy calculation. As in Haley, this conclusion constitutes irreparable harm.
Can I ask you, you're talking a lot about this being a family-owned corporation, yet the corporation is not a party to this action, and as we know, respondent contends that the district court lacked jurisdiction for that reason. Setting aside that overall jurisdiction question, because I'm not sure I agree with respondent on that, but wouldn't the form of equitable relief available be different when you only can deal with the respondent in her individual capacity as opposed to respondent as a corporate representative?
No, Your Honor, because Cheryl Malark is the one who controls the corporation. Cheryl Malark individually made the decision to lock her ex-husband out.
But didn't she make that decision as president of the company, not as an individual in her personal capacity?
It
appears that she was sued in her personal capacity, but
she was sued in her personal capacity. And I don't think we can separate the two. These are husband and ex-wife, and this is an action by one shareholder against another shareholder. In her capacity as a majority shareholder, she decided to lock her ex-husband out and to deny him access to any corporate information. She decided to take unilateral and sole control of the corporation. We asked the court to grant equitable relief to prevent her from continuing these unlawful acts, to end the lockout, and to allow Mr. Malark to have the corporate information that he needs to look out for his own interests in the interests of the trust.
What evidence would you point to suggest that she took those actions in her capacity as a shareholder rather than as president of the company?
Number one, she, on paper at least, is the majority shareholder until November 29, 2022, when the divorce decree says that the stock has to be equalized. And number two, she took the actions as a shareholder because that's the position she was in. She was the majority shareholder. As president, she had equal and co-equal management authority with Douglas Malark. According to his employment agreement, the shareholder agreement, there was two directors of the corporation. They were both directors for life, and those were Cheryl Malark and Douglas Malark. And pursuant to the employment agreement, Doug Malark was entitled to share primary responsibility for management. Those documents were executed incident to the divorce of the parties in 2016.
Help me understand this, because in his employment agreement, as I understand it, he was prohibited from taking a number of actions, which presumably she was not prohibited from taking. Purchase any capital asset over $100,000, sell any asset, execute a lease. There are a number of those. Presumably, she didn't have an employment agreement that prohibited her in the same way that he was prohibited.
Right. We have to look at the circumstances under which the employment agreement came to be. There's only an employment agreement because the parties were divorced in 2016. And under the divorce, for a time being, until November of this year, Cheryl Malark, on paper at least, was the majority shareholder because she and her husband agreed that they wanted to represent to the world that this is a woman-owned company and take advantage of that fact with government contracts and other things. To protect Douglas Malark in the interim until the stock transfers and they're equalized, the employment agreement was executed. And the employment agreement says they shall have shared management responsibility. He shall have all the duties and responsibilities he had prior to the divorce. And other decisions, like the ones you just mentioned and listed, are to be made jointly.
Well, those are, I would call them significant guardrails on his responsibilities?
There's guardrails on both of their responsibilities with the idea, the overriding idea, that they're to share management and run this company equally as though they are 50-50 owners. In fact, there's evidence in the record that the tax implications were always split 50-50. They treated themselves as 50-50 shareholders, not counting the trust, which is non-voting. But that was the idea, protect Douglas Malark until November 29, 2022, when the stock equalizes. Because Cheryl is not supposed to have sole control. She's not supposed to be making all the decisions. They're supposed to be made jointly. That's why we have the shareholder agreement with two directors for life. That's why we have the employment agreement with shared management responsibility.
Well, based on what I saw in the record, they had reached a time in their life where they were unable to jointly manage the company.
They are an ex-husband and an ex-wife. There's no doubt about that.
And from the record, it looks like for the first couple of years after their divorce, they were able to jointly run the company.
Well, what the record says and what Douglas Malark's declaration says is that the company was successful all these years, including the years post-divorce. And if Cheryl Malark was dissatisfied, if she thought there was discord, if they thought the two of them couldn't run the company together, her remedy was to either buy him out or to bring in an equitable action of her own for dissolution or buyout. She instituted, well, she was a part of the buyout process, but it was never consummated, and she never put forth any evidence suggesting that she had the ability to consummate a buyout. In fact, as far as the record goes, the record has been supplemented because the respondents filed a motion to dismiss this appeal, claiming there was a settlement. That motion was denied because there are contingencies and because there's no evidence that Cheryl Malark can finance a buyout. So where we are today, if we go back to the district court and the district court's decision stands, for the next year, for the next 2 years, while this litigation continues, Douglas Malark will be on the outside looking in. Even though 75% of the corporation is his, either individually or through the trust that he represents. He won't have access to any corporation records or information other than what we can get through discovery. He'll have no ability to exercise any semblance of control, even though he was supposed to be one of only two directors for life.
I want to ask you a question about the relief you're seeking from this court. As I understand your argument, it's twofold. One, that the district court abused its discretion by not analyzing Dahlberg Factor 3, the likelihood of success on the merits, and that overall the district court abused its discretion because it failed to recognize the context in which of this closely held corporation. If we agree with you that the findings are inadequate, isn't the remedy to reverse and remand with direction to the district court to do it over again, rather than have this court in the first instance weigh the Dahlberg factors and direct that a temporary injunction issue?
You actually anticipated what I was about to say, which is that the remedy we're seeking today is that this court reverse and remand with specific instructions to reconsider the motion and to reconsider it in the context in which it should have been considered the first time around, which is that these are shareholders of a closely held corporation. This is a 302A.751 action, and it is not an ordinary employer-employee dispute. In fact, that's exactly how the district court treated it. Essentially, the district court metaphorically shrugged its shoulders and said, well, Cheryl Malark's the president, she can do what she wants, and if she wants to lock her ex-husband out and deny him any corporate information, she can do that. That's not a problem. And she reached that conclusion because there was real no analysis of the Dahlberg factors, specifically including the likelihood of success on the merits.
Why can't we read that finding, if you will, on likelihood of success on the merits to really express the district court's assessment that your client hadn't provided the record or hadn't met his burden of proof on that particular factor?
Well,
and if we read it that way, where's the abuse of discretion?
Well, the answer to that is that the record was in large part undisputed before the trial court. The district court identified the likelihood of success as the most important factor, but then devoted three sentences to the analysis and didn't even mention Section 302A, didn't even mention fiduciary duties, which is the undercurrent of this entire action, The record was undisputed based on the divorce decree, the employment agreement, the shareholder agreement, what Douglas Mellark's rights were. And if we look at the statute, 302A, a court can order equitable relief in any action by a shareholder when there's a deadlock in management, undisputed, there was a deadlock, or those in control have acted in a manner unfairly prejudicial to a minority stockholder, director, officer, or employee, defined to include conduct that frustrates the reasonable expectations of the minority shareholder. Being locked out completely with no access to any corporation, being locked out of your office, being locked out of the information is by definition unfairly prejudicial conduct. And that was all undisputed. I see that I'm just about out of time. If the court has any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Joey Balthazar on behalf of respondent Cheryl Mellark. I want to begin by talking a little bit about the record that appellant made below. Appellant claims that the issue before the court when it brought its motion was a 302A claim. But if you look at what Doug filed in support of his original motion and what he filed the night before in his reply brief, you would think it were two different lawsuits. Haley v. Forsell, all the arguments about 302A were brought for the first time in the reply brief after Cheryl had already submitted her opposition. And again, that was the night before the hearing. Motion was filed on...
But wasn't there an amendment of the complaint that added that claim as well?
That's right, Your Honor. And the amended complaint does not appear to be a verified amended complaint. I know the original one that was filed was verified, but the amended complaint doesn't have a verification page. It does add a claim for 302A because it was not so clear in the original one. So when we're talking about the district court's analysis, probably didn't devote a lot of time to the arguments that Doug is making today because they were brought for the first time the night before the hearing and at the hearing itself. The original motion asked the district court for, number one, to declare the employment agreement as a shareholder control agreement. On reply, Doug started to argue that the court needs to look at all of the agreements when deciding whether there's oppression under 302A. And that's when Doug attaches all of the other agreements that he didn't attach originally. Judge Riley, you talked about the offer to sell his shares under what we like to refer to as the Texas shootout provision. Whether Cheryl closes doesn't change the effect of his decision to trigger that provision. He knew at the time that he sent that offer notice that she could accept and buy his shares. And she took a significant first step to do that. She deposited 10% earnest money, and it's in the record.
In your brief, in discussing irreparable harm, you argue that because appellant has agreed to sell his shares to Cheryl, his share status will end before there's a trial on the merits, and therefore there's no irreparable harm. Appellant argues that there was no dispute that the sale was not likely to go through when this matter was argued before the district court. So can you reconcile your position and appellant's position for us or help clarify that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in doing so, address the irreparable harm issue.
This wasn't the first time that Doug tried to sell his shares to Cheryl. The parties were in deadlock, and the buy-sell agreement has a provision that says it is in the company's best interest to have a mechanism to get them out of this. In July 2021, and this is in Cheryl's affidavit at paragraph 29, Doug tried to sell his shares to her. That is when the parties first started negotiating a process to get them out of the deadlock. So when Doug triggered the Texas shootout provision, that was another step indicating or suggesting to Cheryl that he doesn't want to be a shareholder anymore. And his rights as a shareholder disappear once the sale goes through. And whether Cheryl doesn't eventually close is a separate question from whether Doug is entitled to equitable relief under 302A. And that's why the district court is focusing on a lot of the other factors of Dahlberg, like the nature of the relationship between the parties. As your honors recognized, the relationship changed a few years after the divorce. No one disputes that there is deadlock. Judge Cochran, okay.
I'm just wondering about irreparable harm, though. It doesn't seem like you've addressed that.
His argument for his rights as a shareholder disappear when he agrees to sell his shares, because he doesn't have, upon closing, he doesn't have the ability to make the same decisions or to have the same say as he had before. And as Your Honor recognized, the facts regarding the closing are not in the record before the court. As of the time of this appeal, the record reflects that Cheryl had deposited the 10% earnest money.
But doesn't the appellant have a continued interest in supporting and maintaining the value of this company while this whole process is going on?
Maybe in a vacuum, Your Honor, but what the record reflects is that appellant took a lot of acts that were in derogation of the business, and took a lot of acts in self-dealing and in what we call theft and misconduct that were harming the company. And so Cheryl, advised by independent...
Those are allegations at this point, but I understand they're serious allegations. You make an argument that the district court lacked jurisdiction, and I just want to help me understand. As I read Section 302A, 8.751, I mean, it authorizes actions against shareholders, not just against corporations. And so, you know, it seems to me, while you may have an argument about the extent of injunctive relief that may be appropriate, given the fact that MEI is not a party, I mean, I think you would you agree with me that there was jurisdiction for the district court to consider, given the fact that the statute and the contracts support a claim against your client in her individual capacity?
No, Your Honor, not if you consider that if someone else had been appointed as the president or someone had replaced her as the president, then injunctive relief for Cheryl as an individual would be effectively meaningless, because only the company and the president can actually effectuate the relief of bringing that employee back into the business. And the case law on which Doug relies includes the businesses as parties, so suggesting that they are a necessary party and they have a really big interest in what's about to happen. They have independent counsel, and Cheryl took all of the acts as the president of the company.
I want to circle back to a question that Judge Bjorkman asked Mr. Olson, and I'm looking at the district court's one paragraph recitation of the likelihood of success on the merits. It's very hard to review on appeal. Would you agree?
No, Your Honor. We reading between the lines, and we acknowledge there are only a few of them, we agree with Judge Bjorkman. The district court is looking at the record that was, you know, it was Doug's burden to show that he was entitled to the extraordinary remedy of an injunction. All he did was submit an affidavit, well, originally a verified complaint. It wasn't until Cheryl corrected the record that he submitted an opposing affidavit. Didn't take any testimony from anyone at the company, didn't take any testimony from any of the customers, didn't take testimony from any of the friends. It's just two competing affidavits. That's what Your Honor recognized, Judge Riley. So the district court is saying, I see Doug's arguments, I see Cheryl's arguments, I don't think Doug has satisfied his burden. And the district court is also going off of Doug's principal argument that the employment agreement is a shareholder control agreement. District court focused on the relationship between the parties, the administrative burden if an injunction were to issue. Both parties don't dispute that they can't get along. If Doug were allowed back into the office during a pending investigation, it would create a mess. And I want to emphasize, it was a suspension with pay. All of the case law is about termination. What the company did was the one of the most least restrictive acts it could have done, short of termination. So when we're looking at the bylaws and what authority Cheryl has, Doug makes a lot of arguments about how she couldn't do what she did. But Judge Riley, you correctly recognize that there's language about what Doug can do in his employment agreement, not for Cheryl. And if you look at the organizational documents, there's an actual provision for president that says Cheryl will be the president. On top of that, the bylaws contain a mechanism for removal of directors. To do so, you only need a majority vote of the shares. Cheryl can do that. She has majority shares. If you look at removal of an officer, it's silent. But one would think that it should be easier to remove an officer than it is to remove a director. And there's also no restriction on what Cheryl can do vis-a-vis another employee or officer.
But the law requires her to treat other shareholders fairly. And I mean, isn't that the real guts of the argument here?
Correct, Your Honor. But again, it's an equitable claim. Doug came into the court of equity with unclean hands. All of the case law.
Your client came in with unclean hands.
Two competing affidavits in the district court did not agree with Doug's framing of the dispute. And this court is not in the business of weighing evidence on appeal as long as the record supports where the district court landed. And we would say that the record here overwhelmingly supports the district court's ultimate decision to deny an injunction.
Judge Cochran, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to Judge Riley's question about the analysis of the district court's analysis of the likelihood of success on the merits. You know, there's no real legal analysis in that paragraph, so, you know, or any real findings of fact. So considering that, how would you suggest that the district court's analysis is sufficient?
Well, whether to issue an injunction does not rise and fall entirely on one factor. The court it's an abuse of discretion standard. So the court, in its broad discretion, especially in the injunction context, needs to look at all the factors. And yes, there's case law to say the likelihood of success factor is important. It's probably most important for the party seeking the injunction, because if they're not likely to succeed at all on the merits, there's really no point in issuing the injunction in the first place. But even if someone was able to likely prevail, in instances it can outweigh all of the other Dahlberg factors that the court is also required to look at. I want to talk a little bit about factual findings. I think it can be frustrating reading an order and seeing the factual background. You know, do the parties treat everything in the factual background as a factual finding? Well, we would argue that you do. And the court said, Doug agreed to sell his shares, Cheryl started the company, that Cheryl, advised by independent counsel, decided to suspend him with pay. And the district court, applying those factual findings, marches through every one of the Dahlberg factors. And just because, even if the district court, technically speaking, abused its discretion by not giving that factor the full analysis, it still doesn't require reversal. If it's not prejudicial to Doug and on appeal, the
record
supports it.
Then you're really asking us to make that, to weigh the likelihood, aren't you? I mean, because if we really don't have anything to review out of the district court and you're saying we can nonetheless affirm on what is the most significant factor under Dahlberg, likelihood of success, it seems like you're asking us to make the finding that the district court didn't.
No, Your Honor. We're asking this court to acknowledge what the district court did, which is Doug did not put forth enough evidence sufficient to establish a right to an injunction. And the district court, in its likelihood of success analysis, is merely recognizing that Doug did not meet his burden. And it can't.
How do you respond to Mr. Olson on the irreparable harm factors? His client's locked out, can't help ensure that the company is doing the best they can.
It goes to the balance of harms, Your Honor. This is a company that is investigating a suspicion of theft and misconduct. The company has to make decisions that, under the business judgment rule, are in the best interest of the company. Allowing an employee who's under investigation to come back into the office and have access to all of the systems that are under investigation can create a problem. It's not an independent investigation at that point. So the company had to act in its best interest in order to do that. See, my time is almost up. Again, we ask the court to affirm. If there are no more questions, I will sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson, any rebuttal?
Very briefly, Your Honor. I just want to pick up on one comment that opposing counsel made to the effect that the actions that Cheryl Mollark took were the least restrictive things that she could have done. If she really suspected Mr. Mollark of wrongdoing, there were a number of least restrictive actions she could have taken. She could have instituted accounting controls. She could have instituted oversight, all of the things that corporate managers usually do. But instead, what she did was the most extreme thing she could possibly do. Not only did she suspend his employment, she hired security guards to keep a co-shareholder and co-owner with a 75% beneficial interest off the company property, to deny him all access to corporate information, which he still doesn't have today. That is the most extreme thing she possibly could have done. And the theme throughout the arguments before the district court, and one of the themes in the arguments before this court, are that we have repeatedly challenged the respondents to tell us what lawful authority Cheryl Mollark had to take these most extreme and egregious actions. They have never done that. They say she's the president, she can do what she wants. But that's not the law. The law says you have to treat a co-shareholder fairly. And the common law says that you owe a fiduciary duty to a co-shareholder to treat them honestly, fairly, and to respect the rights they have. She respected none of Douglas Mollark's rights. She is now sitting in the chair in sole control of this corporation, even though she has only a 25% beneficial interest. That's not right, it's not the law, and it should not stand. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days.
Thank you.
Thank you.